to form a government and to run a country. All sorts of things have to be organised and dealt with, which a rebel movement can happily ignore. When a revolutionary party finds itself in power, two questions are asked. First, can this movement really do the basic things that government can do better than its predecessors? Was it just a lot of noise which now turns out to be hot air? Or can it really deliver the goods? And second, can it remain true to itself and its original ideals, even though it's now in power? Will it, in turn, become corrupt and just like any other government, starting off in a blaze of glory and good intentions and ending up riddled with corruption and chaos? I think back to when Jeremy Corbyn was first elected to the leadership of the Labour Party. That is the first time, not the second time. Was it September 2015? Those who had joined the party during the election process were excited about this revolution taking place within the party. A man who a lot of us had probably not even heard of months before was now front and centre in our papers and on the news. For the first time in my life, I was really interested to discover what would happen at Prime Minister's Question Time on the first Wednesday after the party conferences. What would Corbyn do? What would he ask? Would he be mellow and soft-spoken? Would he go on the attack? Would he wear a tie? These and other questions. And we know now that it was different, with a question coming from Angela from Norwich via an email. But was it new and fresh? The question was, would it continue to be the same each week? Would Prime Minister's Question Time become less of theatre and more of substance? We like new things and freshness, but is there substance? Well, in the case of Corbyn, we know the answer to the question regarding Question Time. Same old, same old. When Jesus came on the scene, we can only imagine the excitement, the buzz of the crowds. Jesus was starting a revolution, all right. But it was a different sort of revolution from the other ones that had been bubbling up in his days. Jesus had to do two things at the same time. First, he had to show that this movement really was the fulfillment of all that Israel had believed and longed for. And second, he had to show that he and his followers really were living by and dying by the new way that he was announcing. And the tension between these two sometimes seemed fierce. And to this day, many people misunderstand it. Some think of Jesus as just a great Jewish teacher without much of a revolution. Others see him as so revolutionary that he left Judaism behind altogether and established something quite new. But this passage we've had read in Matthew shows us that Jesus held the two together. He was on the one hand offering something utterly revolutionary, to which he would remain faithful. But it was in fact the reality towards which Israel's whole life and tradition had pointed. And here in Matthew, Jesus introduces the main theme of that which will follow. He has come to fulfill the law and the prophets. Most of the rest of the Sermon on the Mount explains what that means, right the way through to chapter 7, verse 11. And then in verse 12 of chapter 7, it's summed up. So whatever you want people to do to you, just do that to them. This is what the law and the prophets is all about. It echoes what Jesus had said in chapter 5. Don't misunderstand why I have come. I did not come to destroy the law and the prophets. And then the Sermon on the Mount finishes with sharp warnings about the urgent need to pay attention to what Jesus is saying. Today's passage is like a gateway to all that will follow. Its theme is clear. Jesus is calling the Israel of his day to be the Israel that God intended, now that he is here. The words then were a challenge to the people of Jesus' day, and they're a challenge to us. And what was said to the people of Jesus' day can be applied to the followers of Jesus today. God had called Israel to be the salt of the earth. But Israel was behaving like everybody else, with its power politics, its fractional squabbles, its militant revolutions. How could God keep the world from going bad, which was the main function of salt in the ancient world, if Israel, his chosen salt, had lost its distinctive taste? And in the same way, God called Israel to be the light of the world. Israel was the people through whom God intended to shine his bright light into the world's darkest places. Not simply to show up evil, but to enable people who were fumbling around in the dark to find their way. But what if the people God had called to be light bearers had become part of the dark? That was Jesus' warning, and it was also his challenge. Jerusalem, the city on a hill, was supposed to be a beacon of hope for the world. His followers were to be like that. Their deep, heartfelt keeping of God's law would be a sign to the nations around them that the one God, the Creator, the God of Israel, was God indeed, and that they should worship him. Now I can imagine the people saying to themselves, well, here's another new teacher who thinks he's got the answers. We've already got teachers of the law. We've already got Pharisees who think their interpretation is right and proper one. So what's the difference with this guy? So Jesus gives his answer straight from the shoulder. The scribes and the Pharisees do teach a way of being faithful to God, a way of behaving in accordance with God's covenant. But God's own sovereign rule, the kingdom of heaven, is now breaking in, and those who want to belong to the new world he is opening up must discover a way of covenant behavior that goes far beyond anything the scribes and the Pharisees ever dreamed of. Pharisees were known for their observance of over 600 laws. They were meticulous in their fastings and tithings and what they wore and how many times they went to the temple to pray. The people were in awe of them. So when Jesus says their righteousness needs to exceed the Pharisees if they are to enter the kingdom of heaven, they must have thought that was impossible. But there were two things that made it possible. One, of course, is the grace of God through Jesus, which comes to us in our failings, for we're never going to be able to achieve 100%. And the other is that Jesus was directing people beyond external observance, which the Pharisees were good at, to what's going on in the heart, to what their motives were, which the Pharisees were not good at. The Pharisees and other teachers of the law through time had either watered down the laws with all their caveats and permissions or had concentrated on the mere external behavior. And so Jesus is saying the laws have been subtly changed and interpreted, but I am giving you the spirit behind the law. Humans look on the outward behavior, but God looks at the heart. The Pharisees, if you like, went through the motions like actors on a stage. They talked a good talk, but their speech was self-serving. They walked a good walk, but their lives were not different internally from anybody else's. Jesus said, your righteousness needs to exceed all of that. And if we aren't sure what Jesus is saying here, Jesus went to show us, in great pains, to show us what that meant with his death on a cross. The law said, don't touch anybody with a skin disease. It might rub off on you. And Jesus touched a leper and said, I choose to make you clean. Some said, that's a little excessive, don't you think? The rules said, don't mingle with sinners. Whatever they might have might rub off on you. Jesus ate with people of ill repute, saying, God desires mercy, not sacrifice. And his enemies said, don't you think that's going a bit too far? The tradition said important people need important positions and important titles. Hanging around people like that and their prestige might rub off on you. Jesus said, don't get caught up on titles and pomp and circumstance. God alone is teacher, and you have a lot to learn. In fact, here's lesson number one. The greatest among you will be your servant. The critic said, aren't you stepping over the line? Well, maybe he was. He practiced what he preached, and he was nailed to a cross. He took upon himself all our failures, all our mistakes, all our broken commands. When we could not live right lives, he showed us the deep righteousness of God. And he said, don't think I come to throw away the Bible. I came to flesh it out and make it complete. Jesus wasn't intending to abandon the law and the prophets. Israel's whole story, its commands, promises, and all, was going to become true in him. But now that he was here, a way was opening up for Israel and through them, the whole world. It would make God's covenant a reality in themselves, changing behavior, not just be teaching, but be a fundamental change of heart and mind. It's truly revolutionary. And at the same time, deeply in tune with the ancient stories and the promises of the Bible. And the remarkable thing is that Jesus brought it all into reality in himself. He was the salt of the earth. He was the light of the world to see, becoming a beacon of hope and a new life for everybody. Jesus is the one who draws people to worship his Father. Jesus is the perfect example of self-giving love, which is the deepest fulfillment of the law and the prophets. That's why these sayings, which originally applied to Israel, now apply to you and me as followers of Christ, and draw on his life and teachings as the source of their own. So how does this challenge affect us today? Where does the world need salt and light right now? Where does Khan need salt and light right now? How through Jesus can we, through following Jesus, provide it? We've been exploring over these past days what kind of church God is calling us to be. In the light of selling a field and all the possibilities that opens up for us. I wonder what it means for you to be salt and light in the world. Behold the salt that you already are. Behold the light that you already are. Become that for the life of the world. Let them taste and see. I can't tell you how to do it. It will be unique for each of us. It will be particular and specific in our own individual circumstances and relationships. I don't exactly know what you will do, where you will sprinkle your salt this week, or where you will shine your light. But I know this. In whatever ways you do that, wherever you do that, and to whomever you do that, you will reveal the embodiment of God in humanity. God with us. In that moment, they and you will taste life and see the world as never before. A few weeks ago, in this place on a Sunday morning, we had Stowe on tour. For those of you who don't know, the Stowe is a church plant not too far away from here on the outskirts of Swindon. Ali Bolton I trained with at Theological College. And 9 years ago, in the March of that year, she and her family were the first to move into a new estate. She had a very strong sense of God saying to her, "All I want you to do in this moment in time is to develop community." And so as everybody arrived, when they arrived in their new house, she would arrive with a basket of goodies, which was paid for by the local churches, and she would hand it over to them to welcome them. And over time, various activities were started in the neighborhood by Ali and others to engender a sense of community on a new housing estate. In fact, somebody did a doctorate and went to Wichelstowe. Now, I'm not much of a sociologist, but there are levels of community. And discovered that in Wichelstowe, only after 3 or 4 years of being there, that the community had developed the highest level of community. And in developing community, people started to ask Ali questions. And so in the telling of questions, they would then say, "Wouldn't it be good if we could meet in an evening and look at Bibles together and discover more?" And so she would set up a Bible study group. Or, "We did something on a Sunday once. Wouldn't it be good if we could meet every Sunday morning?" And so worship started in her home initially, and now in a community hall. Simply because she and others went out of their way to be salt and light in that new community. Or I think of my time in Lebanon. Some of you have heard this story. Rosette works for the Baptist community in the Lebanon, and she looked after Adrian and Julie and I while we were there. During the end of the Civil War went on for 15 years. Lebanon was occupied by Syrian troops. Rosette needed to escape from her flat with her husband and her 18-month-old. There was lots of bombing. They knew what was going to end, but everybody was trying to gain ground. Syrian troops were everywhere. So they decided to get into their car. They drove 200 yards down the road, and they thought what were Lebanese tanks coming towards them, and they were relieved, so they got out of their car, only to find out that they were Syrians. And the Syrians lined them up against the wall. She, with her husband and her 18-month-old, and they were about to be killed, and she prayed that they would kill her first because she couldn't bear to see her husband or her son killed. And then in that moment, Lebanese troops came round the corner, and the Syrians were killed. Move on a substantial number of years, and that 18-month-old is now a young man in a church in Beirut. And as the war started in Syria, many Syrians moved over the border and lived in Beirut. And he stood up, this one young man, one day and challenged his church and said, "We need to do something for these Syrian refugees." And so they started by handing out food supplies. In fact, they have food vouchers. Every month he would have 120 food vouchers, and he had to ration them. So he would give them to the most vulnerable. So he had the most vulnerable families, 120 of them. And one day he called out the names and he handed out the vouchers. He got to 120. Called out the name and they said, "Oh, they've gone back to Syria." So he moved on to his next list of most vulnerable. Called out the name of the family first on the list, and they said, "Oh, they're in the Bekaa Valley visiting family." And for some reason, he didn't follow the list down. He jumped. And I think he went to the fifth name on the list. He went round to their house. And a young lad answered the door and said, "Oh, come in, we've been expecting you." He thought that was strange. Went in, and then mum was there with extended family. And the little boy told his story. The night before, he had cried himself to sleep because he didn't know where his food was going to come from the following day. And as he slept, he dreamt of a man in white walking on water who told him not to worry, that somebody would be sent to help him. And when he got up in the morning, he told his mum, and she believed him, and she invited round the family, and they sat and waited. It makes the hairs on my neck stand on end. And this young man who went to visit them said, "I know who that man is. It's Jesus." Amazing stories of salt and light. Keep the whole picture in view, Jesus said. Blessed are you. You are salt. You are light. I have commandments for you to keep. When we don't keep the commandments, Jesus, when we didn't keep the commandments, Jesus climbed up to the cross and kissed us once again. Ever since, we're under obligation to keep those commandments. And when we can't keep the commandments, he kisses us again and again and says, "I forgive you." And then he requires you to keep them again. On and on it goes, day in, day out. We are continually loved, yet never off the hook. That's what it means to belong to God. And we're called upon to carry out his commandments. Have you ever met somebody like that? It's the person who begins each morning with the words, "Lord, you have claimed me as your own, so I'm going to live as if I belong to you." Let the world taste and see, for you are salt of the earth and the light of the world.